Dr. Mark, that's it. Okay. It'll be a few minutes, a minute or two till he starts, but we're going. We're on.
Okay.
I have a very quick question before we start. Please raise your hand if you came because you saw an ad in the RBS Views. For those of you whose hands were up, if you hadn't seen the ad, would you not have been here? Is it the only place raise your hand again if it's the only place where you saw the ad? Okay. Let's do the same thing for people who saw the ad and hanging up in a shul. Did you see the ad in the shul anywhere hanging up?
Email,
right, okay. Thank you. Ben
Morrison? Okay. Good? All right. Okay. If you can't hear me, let me know. I'm going to try to speak at this volume without the microphone. I don't think we need it here tonight. Good evening. I want to begin by thanking two people who made this evening possible. The Rav Shlita for his leadership in initiating this series, inviting me to speak. And Reb Aryeh, who handled all the logistics as well as the ad and everything else. I understand there will be time for questions afterwards. And please do not feel free to ask in the middle. But if you have to, go ahead, on either side. And of course, the ritual shutting off of the phone or at least turning on to vibrate would be much appreciated. In terms of questions at the end, I realized after I prepared the talk tonight, then I looked at the ad and I saw these questions. I said, wow, these are really good questions, but I don't know if the talk answered any of these questions. So I want to leave some time for myself to ask me these questions, so because it would be false advertising if you came and we didn't at least speak to these questions. So, okay, so let's get started here. Books, articles, podcasts, YouTube seminars, webinars, TED Talks, Torah Anytime. When I saw how much is out there on the subject of dating and marriage, I wanted to rename the lecture, What? Another talk about dating and marriage? As my bubby would say, like a lochen cup, we need another talk about, like a hole in the head, we need another talk about dating and marriage. So I spent some time culling all the material, sifting through it, and there seems to be a consensus on this subject that the world is falling apart, and that we will term that what we will term young divorce is yet another proof positive of this unalterable fact. First the internet, now this. Today in America and in Eretz Israel, there are more therapists and psychology programs in colleges and universities than ever before. There are more people in therapy than ever before. Yet one curious anomaly remains. The divorce rate has yet to go down. In fact, it's still going up. So what gives? I mentioned this to someone I work with, and he said, okay, so let's get rid of all the therapists. Ha ha ha. I get that all the time. Okay. So, tonight, I want to dissect this phenomenon happening in our community and in Klal Yisrael, namely, young divorce, broken engagements, something I'll call Shana Rishona blues, and the general feeling of anxiety and stress that's woven itself into the fabric of our lives when it comes to the subject of dating and Shaduchim. It has been called, and perhaps rightly so, the Magefa of our generation. It was Chicago, late 1960s. The South Side, the roughest neighborhood in America at that time. It was Saturday night, and my chavrusa of many years in Muncie was a young intern then, and he was pulling the graveyard shift at the local hospital. He was working 11 p.m. to 6 a.m. as a resident in training. He had switched with a friend of his so he could keep Shabbos, so the head of the emergency medicine gathered all the residents all around. And he says, okay, in a few minutes here, they're going to come wheeling these guys in. There's going to be gangs and fights and violence all over, and there's going to be wheeling somebody in with a knife stuck in his forehead. What do you do? What do you do? So one resident yelled out, we'll order blood. We'll order all the types of blood. The chief said, nah, don't do that. Another guy pipes up and he says, we'll check all the vital signs. He says, nah, don't do that. So he says, here's what you do. He says, when they start wheeling them in and you get overwhelmed and you don't know what to do, he says, take your two fingers, put it on your wrist, take your own pulse, check yourself. If you're pumping too fast, you're no good to me. Go home. Get out of here. I only need people with calm heads. So in the spirit of checking our collective pulse around this issue, let's proceed. In the mid-1980s, the city of New York hired a new subway director by the name of David Gunn. David Gunn was famous for implementing at the time a radical approach to fixing the New York system and subway system that was close to collapse and overrun with violent crime. It was called broken windows theory, maybe some of you remember that, and it goes something like this. If a window is broken, says the theory, and left unrepaired, people walking by will conclude that no one cares and no one's in charge. Soon more windows will be broken and eventually you'll have chaos. In short, broken windows theory says that an epidemic can be reversed, can be tipped, by tinkering with the smallest details of the immediate environment. So what did David Gunn do? He decided the biggest problem facing the New York City subway system was graffiti. His detractors quipped that worrying about graffiti and the New York subway system was as pointless as scrubbing the decks of the Titanic as it headed toward the icebergs. But David Gunn persisted. He set up cleaning stations, bought special paint, he ordered new cars, he prosecuted everybody who would write graffiti at night, the kids would sneak in, and it worked. It took time, but eventually it worked. The epidemic was reversed, was tipped by, again, tinkering with the smallest details of the immediate environment. The advertisement says, Rabbi Mordechai Mark said, I'm not rabbi, I'm just one of those guys they call rabbi because, you know, I'm standing up here. You know, what else are you going to do? But I'm a therapist. I'm a trained therapist. I've been in practice here at Yerushalayim for over 20 years. I work with people, not environments or trends. Progress to me is measured incrementally. That means small steps heading hopefully in the right direction. This is how people change as far as I'm concerned, and this is how people are built. My clinical definition of hope is doing the same old, just a little differently. I worked with a young man, I still work with him, but the story goes back a few years. He's in his mid-20s, he's married about a year or so. He told me the following story. He works in downtown LA, and his wife was going to be around where he was working that day, and they made up to meet at a certain store and where she was going to do a little shopping, and then they were going to go out to eat. He walked into the store, and he's walking into the store. He saw her at a distance. She couldn't see him, but he saw her. And he stopped for a second, and he was looking at her. She was looking at something and wearing a backpack, and it was bulging with books and a water bottle and stuff hanging all over the place. And he was looking at her, and he was just sort of transfixed there. He was telling me the story, and he was struggling to tell me what he was feeling as he stared at her, without her knowing that he was looking at her. I made him tell me. "What were you feeling?" he said. "What were you feeling?" I asked him. So here's the partial list. He said he was feeling that she was uncool, nerdy, had bad posture, was not elegant, his word, and she was embarrassing. You see, he grew up in a very privileged house, and the women in his family, quote unquote, didn't schlep. Schlep nicht, we don't schlep. So that was deeply embedded into his idea of femininity. Women don't schlep. She, of course, grew up with very little, worked her way through college, was now in grad school, and carried her books wherever she went. He admired her when they were going out because of her grit, her work ethic. But like many young men, he wanted everything. He wanted her to be everything. He wanted her to be elegant, graceful, and with a blue-collar work ethic, all rolled into one. "What do I do?" he asks. "I don't want to look at her badly." "Buy her a pocketbook," I said. "A nice one, a big one." "Huh? How's that going to help?" "Don't worry," I said. "Just get it. She'll get the point." "The backpack for you is symbolic." He said, "Explain it to me." So I said, "It's a symbol. It's clumsy, it's dirty, it's all the stuff you don't like." "Change the symbolism," I said. The lesson: you can tip things by tinkering with small details. Did it change things around completely? Not completely. Did it shift his attitude for what Dan Weil, a mentor of mine, a therapist out in Oakland, from what Dan Weil calls shifting from adversarial to collaborative? When he first saw her, he was adversarial to her. Hopefully, not only this intervention, but in the terms of getting her the pocketbook, it would switch to collaborative. Judgmentalism kept him in the problem. It blinded him from taking a leadership role towards solution and resolution. Lesson: in order to change the system, you must start by changing an attitude, one person at a time. So in that spirit, let's look at some of the reasons why I think young marriages are spiraling down or quickly dissolving, and talk about ways to change the attitude that drives the spiral. Social Pathology magazine asked the question a few years ago, I think it was 2014. They asked, "What is the most desirable quality in a partner that you're looking for?" Does anybody want to guess? What's the most desirable quality in a partner? Desirable quality in a partner that you're looking for?
Looks.
Looks.
I'm thinking about them, not...
Yeah, of course.
Someone, yeah,
no, would I think differently? Yeah, I wouldn't think. Looks. Anything else?
Compatibility.
It's hard to look for compatibility, but it's yeah, I hear. Good. Anything else? Anyone else? What else?
Willingness to work on the marriage.
A willingness to work on the marriage. Compatibility with a little connection. Good. Very good.
Excitement.
Excitement. There you go. Excitement. Excitement. Did a man say that or a woman say that? A man said this. Yes. Harav?
It's like Pasha.
Pasha.
Shared values.
Shared values.
Romance.
Romance. Just shout out all at one time. I'll feel at home like I'm at my Shabbos table and everybody shouts at him. Good midos. The answer is trust. Trust. It's a big word. There are many types of trust. Can I trust you to take this deposit to the bank this morning? Can I trust that it'll get in? Can I trust that it'll actually happen? Can I give it to you and just put it out of my mind? Can I trust? That's a trust of competence. What most people come to me for, though, is something I would call a lack of relational trust. Can I trust you to be there when I'm upset? Can I trust you to choose me over your mother? Work the crowd, Mordechai. Work the crowd. Can I trust you to choose me over your family or friends? These are young adults. Friends are important. Family's important. Not just moms. They're two different categories. Can I trust you to not drink too much at the Sholem Zocher? Can I trust you to not take drugs? Can I trust you to respect me, to help me, to not embarrass me? Can I trust you to not look at the internet? Relational trust is subtle. It's not about making a deposit at a bank. It's about making emotional deposits in a joint emotional bank account. I work with a fine young man in his late 20s who has been going out with a young woman for, I think, 3 or 4 months now. Things have gotten serious. They took off July 4th weekend to meet her parents. Her parents are, let's say, simple folks. Her father had an hour to spend with him before the World Cup game come on, and he had to, of course, go. My guy was devastated. He came back from the trip and he looked like somebody had punched him in the gut. Had he ever wanted to run away, now he had a reason. But he loves her. Should he confide in her about this? Could he trust her with his feelings? He was afraid. Could she trust him to be there for her? What do you think? Should he tell her? What do you think? Yeah. Who said that? Yes? You should tell her. Just like straight.
No, gently.
Go for it. Women, straight?
Gently.
Gently. Yes, but gently.
Yeah.
Adin. Adin shouldn't tell her. Shouldn't tell her. Hands, should tell her? Hands. Shouldn't tell her. Interesting. A lot of sitting on the side watching the hands. Okay. He didn't know if he could trust her. He didn't know if he should trust her. He didn't know who was more important to him, his kala to be, his kala, his wife to be, or his therapist, actually. Yes.
Trust.
I'll get there. Relational trust. No? Hak the shear. Hak the shear.
Why is that trust? I mean, in order for him to go further, he's got to open up to her. But why is it trust?
Because he has to trust. He has to trust that he's not going to be shouted down. He has to trust that if he shares this feeling, that it's going to be heard.
Well, that's why you should do it gently.
Yes.
Whether this is the time to bring them.
Right. July 4th, he doesn't want a lot of fireworks, right? okay. I don't know, it's a genetic thing. It's incorrigible. Right, it's a good point. Timing is everything, right? It's good. I'm going to try to answer your question. It's a good question. The question is better than my answer. I'll tell you a story. Rav Shach, that's all. He was giving. He when we gave psicha in Panovich, he would get about 3 seconds in, and they would all start hocking, and then the gabbai would come give a klop, and then all settle down. And then he would start in again, and then he wouldn't get so far, and they would start interrupting him all the time. So when the mirror opened, they invited Rav Shach to give psicha. So he came in, and everybody was mishtoimim, you know, at the, and he walked in, and he started his psicha, and he started in, and my shah still, the whole crowd was quiet, and didn't quite know what was going on, and he started in again. He goes, no, and he told the gabbai, he said, this is not, so he was used to the, he was used to the rosh. I'm going to try to answer your question about relational trust. Why relational trust for a man is so challenging? Because of the one fear that he had and that all men have, fear of failure. Fear of failure. You squinted your eyes at trust because what does trust have to do with it? You're right. What sits underneath trust is fear. He was afraid of not being heard. He was afraid of not being able to share completely. And he wanted to do so, but he couldn't do so. Or he was afraid to do so. So relational trust for a man is challenging because the fear of failure. In business, it's the fear of going bankrupt. In family, it's the fear of not belonging. In relationship, it's the fear of not being a good husband and not being a good father. Contrary to popular belief, every man that I've ever sat with and every man I know, that's his, one of his strongest, if not the strongest, desire to be a good husband and a good father and a good man. Every man wants to be a good husband and father, and every woman wants to be a good wife and a good mother. Many young marrieds that I sit with, they list one of the reasons that they don't want to get divorced. One of the top reasons is they don't want to fail. They don't want to see themselves as failures. They don't want to have a failure on them. And we can all understand such a thing. So what was her fear? Her fear, because I work with her as well, is having grown up with a father who prioritizes the World Cup over meeting her cousin, she had, as we would expect, a fear of emotional abandonment. Someone running away from her. If she got upset, who is there to be there for her? So there they were, the two of them. It was quite a perfect alignment of abandonment and fear of sharing. So I asked him like this. I said, you want to run away, right? Right, he said. So I asked him, I invited him to go deeper. Underneath the wanting to run away, what's underneath the running away? He said, fear of failure. I said, okay, what was the failure? He said, the failure was, I don't want to feel like I'm not choosing the perfect person. And if she doesn't have a good family, then it's not. Then she's not the good. She's not the perfect person for me. Not choosing well was driving his lack of trust, and was driving his own fear. So I said, okay. So what sits underneath that? And he says, wanting to do well. I said, okay. So he was almost. He was done with his fears. So what sits underneath wanting to do well? So there, here he paused. He had ran out of his fears. He said, you know what sits under all of this? All of my fear of not choosing well, and all of my fear of not marrying the right person, and all of my fear of wanting to do well and perhaps being disappointed? I said, no, what? He said, love of life. That's what it all sits on. Now, when you think about it, it sounds like a non sequitur. What does love of life have to do with all these fears? Thoughts? Oh, I got you. Okay.
You only get to do it once. You only get to do it once. So make the decision right the first time.
Make the decision right the first time. But what does it have to do with love of life?
He's afraid he's going to be miserable.
I'm sorry?
He's afraid he's going to be miserable.
Afraid he's going to be miserable. Don't afraid to be speak out. It's good.
Is this a new thing?
I'm sorry?
Is this a new thing?
Yeah. Like I just made it up because I want to write a book about it?
It's a new thing for this generation. I didn't think that way when we were looking to get married.
It's a new
excitement
thing.
Excitement of life? I mean, who thought of that?
You say excitement of life, you said love of life.
Love of life. Well, isn't that the same thing?
Right. Okay. Right.
He wants to be happy.
He wants to be happy.
Yeah, but everybody wants to be happy. It's different. It's different.
Yeah. Guys? Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead. I'll get to you.
I just said, the whole challenge of life.
We're recording, so don't be afraid to speak up. I'm sorry to interrupt.
The whole challenge of life, the vicissitudes of life. You want to engage them, so these fears are part of the engagement of one's life.
Right. Right. Okay. Anyone in the back?
He's already on a continuum. He's not already on a continuum of his life. He's got a certain path that he's been on that he's happy about.
Yeah.
He can see that continue.
Yeah.
But if he makes the wrong choice, something's going to interrupt that and shatter his worldview and his progress.
Okay.
He wants something that's going to line up with what he already believes to be the right way to run a life.
Okay. Good. I told him, I don't know if it was about love of life, I told him I thought what sits underneath all of it was a sense of greatness that he had, and that the fear were mechitzas, there were guardians of that greatness, because you just don't get greatness, you have to earn it. And we all know this model of earning greatness from elite athletes. It's a very straightforward metaphor that, you know, no pain, no gain. But how do you translate that no pain, no gain into relationality? What is the hard work that you have to do? What is the pain that you have to do in order to get the gain of that relationship? So the hard work is going through the mechitzas of the fears that he needs to go through in order to arrive at something very, very deep inside of him, which was his greatness. Underneath all those fears is your love of life, your greatness, your power, your strength. You have nothing to worry about, I told him. Your life path is clear. Show up to your fears and you'll trust your spouse. Lesson: show up to your fears and take her advice when she tells you that you don't have to watch the World Cup with a schwer if you don't want to. Two, the second thing, and I made a whole list of them, but I'm just picking out a few here. The second thing that speaks to me, and even though there's a big list, I'm choosing things that I see every day, and it's just very apparent to me, even though it's anecdotal evidence because I'm, you know, one man with one practice, but I think it correlates across the board as well in national statistics. But the second thing I see that is a reason for spiraling down a relationship is what I would call red line bad midos. John Gottman is a famous researcher in University of Washington, Seattle, and he talks about the four negative patterns of behavior that predict divorce. The first one is criticism. Criticism fuels the attack, leading to escalation of conflict. The message of criticism is very clear: I'm perfect, you're defective. B, contempt, mocking, acting superior. It actually has been documented, this is a wild fact, and I looked at this study. It actually has been documented by a recent study at Ohio State University that partners on the receiving end of contempt experienced erosion of their immune system. If you think there are any coincidences in life, then you're absolutely wrong. If somebody could put that together for me, I'm glad to go to you for a supervision. Can you imagine such a thing? The erosion of the immune system to being on the receiving end of contempt? It's crazy, but it's not so far away. It's not so far to imagine.
When you're emotionally distraught, the immune system definitely suffers.
Right. Right. C, defensiveness, not taking responsibility for being part of the problem. D, stonewalling, that's mostly guys. All these others can go either way, gender-wise. When I say he or she in this lecture, it's almost interchangeable. Sometimes it's slanted to one gender or the other. I'm sorry? Stonewalling means...
Not talking to each other?
Yeah. Dafka not talking to each other.
Right, like going for periods of time without speaking to each other.
Without speaking, avoidance. Anger can be stonewalling. A guy walks in, hasn't been home all day, he walks into the dinner time, and the place is, you know, is rocking, and he has a suit, you know, he has his briefcase, and he just walks in the door, and before he even puts the briefcase down, she says, you know, the bank called today. And he says, I haven't even put my briefcase down, you're talking about the bank. And he goes into a, he flies off, and everything goes downward from there. What has the anger done? Technically, what has he accomplished by that?
Stop the interaction.
He stopped the discussion that he doesn't want to have. That's stonewall. So whatever is the most effective way, and usually it's not even about what's most effective, it's about what he's learned. Whatever you grew up with. I'm from a patriarchal generation, generation of stonewallers. Good Russian peasant folk, hardworking stonewallers. We don't want to talk about it. Thank you very much. I'll try to do better next time. We don't want to talk about it. We're not talking about it. And we're going to show how tough we are by not talking about it. Okay, mostly guys, cold silence. It spells the end of days. Unless, of course, your partner is used to it, then she feels right at home. It's actually a falsely heroic attempt by guys to not make it worse. It's interesting. It looks passive-aggressive, you know, everything today is either bipolar or passive-aggressive, but it's actually neither. It's actually an attempt to not make it worse. The problem is, nice try doesn't work, it makes it worse. Gottman's right, most young couples I see live right here in these four red line bad midos. It's slow, hard work changing these. When they say marriage is hard work, marriage is hard work, 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 you know, marriage is hard work, this is what they're talking about, changing this. And if it doesn't change, it's divisive, and it degenerates, and it really adds to the degeneration of the couple. The third thing that I've seen in the office, I call the stubborn insistence on romantic definition of love. The romantic definition of love is an instinct. It's what I feel. The reality is, love is a skill. You can teach it, you can learn it. To love, what does it mean? It means the willingness to interpret someone's not very appealing behavior in order to find a more benevolent reason why it might be unfolding. In short, dan lechavschus. Now, I like the English version of this better than the Hebrew because I think it's the dan lechavschus has been so overused it's almost lost its meaning. You know, like Rev Gershenfeld would say, if you want to lose the meaning of a pasuk, just make it into a song. So dan lechavschus, it's almost lost its meaning because it's too general. But I think this is really what it's talking about. It's you're really striving, and this is a definition of love. You're striving all the time, and the reality is that the average number of interactions that you have with your spouse on a daily basis or on a weekly basis are in the thousands and tens of thousands. So you get constant experience. You get your 10,000 hours of perfecting this, of trying to master it. Very, very quickly. All you have to do is switch it into trying to find a more benevolent reason why it might be unfolding.
Could you repeat the definition again?
Yes, sure. Thank you.
I'm going to take water in here.
To love means the willingness to interpret someone's not very appealing behavior in order to find a more benevolent reason why it might be unfolding. It's the willingness to interpret someone's not very appealing behavior not in the normal way, the first language way of saying that's bad, her briefcase is appalling, her backpack is embarrassing to me, what's wrong with her, she's lesser than, and trying to find a more benevolent reason why it might be unfolding. We think when we marry, we're out to find partners who will make us happy. That's the romantic version. The reality is, really, we're out to find partners that give us the sense of the familiar. And familiarity, how we experience love or didn't experience it growing up, is usually bound up with conflictual messages. Romantic thinking thinks that the more a person is right for us, the less we'll have to explain who we are, what we feel, what upsets us. We believe a true mate will guess what's in our minds. When this doesn't happen, it leads to, guys, sulking. A man I worked with, true story, he left the dinner table when he felt he wasn't being spoken to respectfully. He went to his room and waited. What were you waiting for, I asked.
The Brady Bunch, his wife, to come and tell him.
What were you waiting for, I asked. I was waiting for her to come in and apologize. Did she? No. So let me guess, I said. Did your parents ever come to your room to console you when you had a meltdown? Nope. How'd you know, he said. I don't know, I said. Just lucky guess. The romantic thinking. The fourth reason. Divorce is contagious. David Phillips, UC at Davis, did a study about 7 years ago. And this is what he did. He looked back at all the headlines of newspapers from the late 1940s to the late 1960s. And whenever there was a suicide and it made the headlines, it made the front pages, he got those headlines. He got those dates. And then he went and he found out, he correlated those dates when the suicide made the front page. He got those dates of when there were how many suicides were there when those headlines after those following days. And he wanted to see if it correlated between the headlines in the paper and the number of suicides that were happening at that time and soon after. And he found out that they correlated 1-to-1. He found out as soon as there was something in the headlines, there was something happening in the world, in society. Divorce as a social phenomenon has acquired a certain familiarity, what they call in social psychology a certain stickiness. It has become somewhat trivialized and thus more commonplace. As the trend gains more momentum, it becomes more and more the default choice. The message. Human decisions are subtle and complicated and not very well understood. Do not underestimate the power of peers to influence decisions of epic proportion. 5. Another reason that I see of divorce. The hero's journey, I call it. Or in this case, the heroine's journey. The divorce statistics in the United States began to really climb when one significant factor was also happening to women at the same time. Does anybody know what that is?
Independence.
Women's lib. What else? Women's lib? Confirmation? What was somebody over here?
Getting out
in the workforce. There you go. Bingo, right there. They were entering the workforce. Oh, okay, you're right. You get a B, you know, B plus, A minus.
Okay.
92, not 89, 92. They were entering the workforce. As soon as they start entering the workforce and start making money, the divorce numbers start to climb. As women started to make serious more money, divorce rates climb. What does that tell you? It tells me that women, now with earning power, could finally do what they've wanted to do for a long time but couldn't afford to. That is divorce and start over again. And that's what's happened. And that, I believe, has had a hashpoah. That hashpoah has trickled down to us as well. Women's empowerment. Yes, sir.
If I can interrupt you. You're saying that
please.
You're saying divorce is a good thing. And according to this logic, that divorce was so low because they couldn't do it and they weren't happy. Now that they're getting divorced,
yeah,
the sign of happiness.
I'm not putting the word good or bad to the divorce. I'm saying this is how my understanding of what they did, because before they wanted to, and there are reasons for this. Before they wanted to, but they couldn't. Why? Because they were trapped. When everyone grew up in the village, there was no such thing as divorce. There was no way that she was going to be able to do anything but stay within the tribal rules.
So right? Don't you want to say it's a good thing to divorce that? Meaning it's a good thing. They couldn't do it, now they can.
But
yes.
They don't put the effort anymore. That's what he's saying.
But
it's not worth it for them to put the effort into marriage, because they can just work it out way.
It's good, you can touch it
no,
either
it
way.
No, to get out of something that they were trapped in.
Right.
Bad situation, not a good marriage.
Right. 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 I mean, good, bad. I mean, you can think of it either way. Yeah, I think of it both ways. I think it was good for them in terms of their ability to do something, to be free to do it. And on the other hand, it created the exit strategy right from the beginning. So, women's empowerment, the personal growth movement, increased stature and society have all contributed to the sense of women no longer standing for the status quo in relationship. What I mean to say is that many women today divorce not because they necessarily want to, but because they feel they can and foresee a brighter future ahead, whereas before they didn't see a brighter future ahead. This is a relatively new concept in modern society. Many young women who have the emotional and financial backing of their families often see divorce as a pragmatic choice, not necessarily a tragedy. There are many more reasons why young people divorce today. I've picked out only a few, and so next week I'll talk more about this. Okay, so in conclusion, I want to tell you a story. It's about my son, and he was on a train. He was going to Petah Tikva. And he was going to get off the train to take a bus to go play baseball. And on the train, he fell asleep. And he woke up to not the conductor, but one of the guys on the train screaming at him, "We're at the stop, we're at the Tachana, and you got to get off, you got to get off." And he woke up and he was startled, and he didn't know, you know, where he was. And before he knew anything, he tapped the side of his pocket where his wallet was, and it wasn't there. But the guy was screaming at him, "You got to get off, you got to get off the train." So he left his wallet, and he got off the train, and he took his backpack. And he figured it must have fallen off when he fell asleep. The guy is screaming. So he makes a decision, he gets off the train. And later, when he gets off the train, he realizes that his baseball glove is not in his backpack, where it usually is. So when he sweep, he got all whacked out. So now he's in a panic. With a wallet, he wasn't in the panic, but now with the baseball glove, he was in a panic. So now he has to figure out what to do. So he borrows a couple of shekels from his friend. And he gets back on another train, and he goes, that's where the end of the line is, and he goes to Herzliya, and he finds the train, after a lot of running around, he finds the train that he fell asleep in, and lo and behold, by the grace of God, the cleaning lady was there, and he said, "Did you find anything there?" And she said, "Yeah, I found this," and she had the baseball glove. Very good.
Not the wallet.
No wallet. So I ask him, "Why didn't you go back for the wallet?" So he says, Well, there's nothing in it, only my Ravkov, and I could replace that. So I asked him, would you have gone back if there was 50 shekel in it? He looked curious. 100 shekel, I asked. Come on, Abi, he says. You know what you're always telling us about kids of psychologists, you know? Well, chill out. The question remains extant. Life is not about what you want, it's about how much you're willing to pay for it. And how much you're willing to pay for it depends on how much it's worth it, is how much it's worth it to you. My son loves baseball, and he loves his glove. So our question here tonight is not whether we want to be married. Everyone wants to be married. The question is, how much are we willing to extend ourselves for? The lesson. Before you get married, make sure you feel at least as strongly about your shidduch as my son feels about his baseball glove. Thank you. Okay, so before I open up to your questions, if there are any, I want to answer the questions that are on the dating and marriage, the advertisement over here, but not necessarily. If anybody has any questions first, I'll be happy to take them. Yes, sir.
Did you address one of your final points was that it's easier to divorce because women are financially independent, they work on their own, they can get out and they don't have to be dependent on the husband anymore. In today's day and age, in the last number of years, women are demanding that from the husbands, of course, the first tend to favor women anyway, as far as alimony and that kind of thing. So can you address that and as an outgrowth of that kind of, that whole phenomenon?
Yeah.
There's a growth in the men's movement now of men being independent and not getting wanting to get married again. Just going their own way.
Okay, see how long that lasts. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so there are a lot of people out there that are going that way.
You should see the statistics on divorced men. Divorced men don't live as long. Divorced men get in more car accidents. Divorced men, their health deteriorates.
It's not a string neck all the time. Don't do this. It does help.
Yes. Absolutely. He said men have a good time being married. That's what he said. That was I think I heard it right. Yes.
Question that last statement you said.
Which one?
Which was you should love, when getting married, you should love your...
Yeah, you should love your spouse as much as you love your baseball glove. Yeah, I got it, yeah.
But in the shidduch world, it doesn't really work that way. How are you going to love that person?
I didn't say love, I said feel strongly.
Feel strongly about why
I
make it.
Yeah, I said feel strongly. I knew you were going to be here, I knew you were going to ask me. So, yeah, it does work that way. I mean... Like next week, you know, we'll talk about what we can do, what small things, like, you know, like broken windows theory. We can do small things. So maybe this is one of the small things. How's the shidduch today? The guy comes home, you know. Nice, she's a nice girl, you know, great family, nice. The mother says, if you say nice one more time, I'm going to, you know, sugar govern with a nice, you know. Is she my team? Is she this? Is that, you know, you don't need nice, she says. I had a mother like that. She goes, you said nice? She says, yeah, she's very nice, very nice. She said, this is not for you. Not for you. She was right, kind of her. Premarital counseling, help or hype? Help. Why not? It's not hype. But I think the thing that predicts good outcome from premarital counseling is the people want to be there. You know, it's kind of a nice thing when someone comes up and says, you know, we're thinking of getting married in a few weeks or a few months or tomorrow, and you never know. And we'd both like to come in to talk about some things. Okay, that's a good predictor. Is it going to solve their problem? Unfortunately, The hype part is that they think, oh, we're going to go to a therapist, we're going to solve it, we're going to perfect ourselves before we walk down the aisle. That doesn't happen. Usually the best thing that's going to happen is that the therapist, if he's good, you know, is going to say, okay, this is your dysfunctional pattern. But don't worry, that's the good news. And part of that good news, 1A, is that everybody has dysfunctional patterns. Every couple has them. So let's talk about it like big boys and girls and say, okay, when you do this, he does that. When you do that, he does that. And this is the way, and we can improve on that, but let's call it the way we see it, and so we can improve on that. And then, if they hear that, then they're on their way, because then it's on their way to a mature marriage. It's not the way to an idealized marriage. Idealization in marriage leads to denigration in marriage. It's a very, very one-to-one correlated happening. Yes, sir.
Premarital counseling for 20-year-olds.
Yes.
Where are you expecting 20-year-olds to go for premarital counseling?
I don't know. Wherever. Why? What's the problem? Yeah.
How comprehensive is the custom class?
Well, look, the advent of therapists and counselors and all that is only, you know, mokum she'nish. I mean, it's, you know, they get a little from this, they get a little from that, and the Rebbe thinks like this, and the chassid teacher thinks like that, and both of them are kind of, we don't really know, maybe you should go to a therapist. I mean, that's the world I live in, that, you know, that it's kind of, you go around and round and round until you wind up with somebody. Yeah. You bet. You bet. That's right. That's right. When you were 20 years old, how did you call home when you were in yeshiva? I'm still waiting for that asimon that I used when I was 20 to drop, you know. No, I'm not making fun of your question, but you're right. It's a phenomenon. It's a very modern phenomenon. The world has worked very. Do I think it will help? I think it's not hype. I think it could help.
Maybe if it's a 20-hour session.
Okay.
Not for now.
No, I on these type of things. Sometimes I've had long, you know, 3-4 hour sessions. Sure. Yes, all the time. Sure. But it's not meant to, it's meant to give clarity. It's not meant to necessarily give resolution. I mean, that's, but the point is well taken. Yeah. How do you know red flag when you see one? My take on that question is, you see them all the time. And then you start second-guessing, and then you start triple-guessing. What's after quadruple-guessing? You see it, but you pretend it's not there. You see it, you don't want to see it. And you see it, and this is, I think, the most popular response is, you see it, but you marginalize it. You think it's not that big a deal. You think we could. It's not that much. And then, lo and behold, it becomes bigger than you thought down the road. And that's what contributes to early divorce as well.
What's an example?
What is it that we're talking about?
A red flag?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't want to get into all the specifics because it gets into diagnoses, it gets into, you know, if you saw, let's say, a bad midah, he picked you up and you're in the car and there's traffic and he starts yelling or using language that you've never heard before, and then he says, oh, you know, and then he makes a joke and then you go on your way and the traffic clears. And you go and have a nice time, and you come home, and your mother says, how was it? And you go, fine, you know. And she goes, you want to talk about it? She goes, no. And she goes to bed. And then the next thing, she wakes up, and it's still there. There's something there. He's a nice guy. Back and forth. So where does that go? What do you do with that? Is it something real? Is it something not? Is she a nervous Nelly? Is she real? You know. So, what I'm saying is, it's usually there, and we pretend it's not there, and the Eitzah is, don't pretend it's not there. Think about it, talk about it, and that's really the Eitzah for all these, is that when you talk about it, when you talk it out, because the majority of people that I see with marriages on the brink after 6 months, usually one, if not both of the spouses, their experience in Shidduchim has been they did it alone. They were alone. Guys are usually more than women. Women are much better at talking it out. They're much better at networking. They're much better at having a best friend or a mom or somebody. Guys are good at making it look like they have people they talk to, but they don't really talk to them. The reason why they're therapists, one of the reasons why they're therapists in the world today, in the firm world, is because you're not going to tell your Rebbe everything. You're just not. And so they're in sort of this Hobson's choice. What do you do? How do you know a red flag when you see one? You know more than usual, than you're willing to admit.
Does red flag usually always mean stop the process or not?
No, not at all. It doesn't have to at all. It's a very good question. It doesn't have to mean that. The chances are when somebody's... I'm sorry? The question is, does red flag mean that it's the end of the process? It's an ikuv to the whole process. And the answer is absolutely not. Chances are there's a red flag on the other side too. Two red flags make one big red flag. Two red flags mean a marriage made in heaven. Associated question here is, where does listening to your gut play a factor? And the answer is, it always... you had a question.
Finish first?
Okay, I'll finish first. Where does listening to your gut actually play a factor? And the answer is, it always plays a factor. Listening to your gut means that what I'm feeling is real. And please, whether you're a man or a woman, honor that as a reality. It doesn't mean, where we get mixed up is we say, I'm listening to my gut, and therefore we make the next step, which is I'm going to poskin from my gut. Listening to your gut is perfect for validating yourself and validating what you're feeling. And this is real, what's going on inside of me. It doesn't necessarily mean, I think this has to do with the red flag question, is, okay, I see this red flag. I see he has this issue, let's say, because he always has it. I see he has this issue over here. And my gut says that this is trouble, okay? Now, when I acknowledge that, now I have to move over to the second stage, the second shlav, which is, do I poskin from that? Poskining from that gut feeling is a whole different experience. Is a whole different thing. And that's the answer to that question. Wait. He was first. You were first.
I've listened to a Shiva Rabbi.
Yes.
That speak up tells his guys that they don't see at least four faults in a potential spouse.
Yes.
Forget about.
Yeah. Good visit.
Yeah, good visit.
What's
the difference between that and
the degree? I'm sorry? He said, Reb Noah Kleinberg Zatzal said that if you're going out with on a shidduch and you don't see four faults, I don't know four faults, but I think the dogish is on you see four faults, meaning you have to see things that are wrong with her to be normal, to have to be in a normal shidduch. He said, if you don't see that, then there's something wrong. And the question is, what's the difference between seeing a fault and seeing a red flag? And my answer was, it's not the only answer, my answer is the degree of what you're seeing. You can see a mida ra, let's say, but a red flag would be something that you feel that you don't necessarily, you can't live with, like the kavadon. As I say, there's a red line and it goes below it. How much do you really know about someone before you get married? I wrote down potentially everything. It depends on how honest and mature you are. I think everything we see is encoded in every interaction. Usually when we go out, we're like a deer in the headlights on Shidduchim, and unless we have someone to speak things out with, a lot gets missed. So as I said before, many problems in marriage start when one of the spouses does the Shidduchim alone. And by alone, I don't mean physically alone, I mean psychologically alone. They're not sharing everything. They have questions, they have sfeikas, and they're not speaking it out. And then, lo and behold, their worst fears become realized because they never really were in contact with somebody in a strong enough way to solidify what they were thinking and feeling. That being said, how much do you really know about someone before you get married? Look, we all know people are good actors and actresses, and we're all not trained psychologists, and even if we were, that also doesn't help. It's a problem. Maybe next week I'll have to address this about one of the issues that I didn't talk about today was this issue of discovery. What do you do when you discover something 6 months in, 2 months in, on the sixth date, when it's mukubal that the third date is when, if there's a disclosure, that should be then. But I had a case where somebody disclosed something very, very thought-provoking, let's say, on the eighth date. They were very, very down the line with it. And it wasn't so much, the issue was not so much what was revealed, it was so much it was revealed on the eighth date. And once that happened, then all sorts of trust issues set in. Because she had a... What? Okay, so let's leave it at that. Okay. Anything else? Yes?
I have two questions.
Yes?
First of all, from what I understood, the way you were describing failure was as divorce. As a mother...
I'm just repeating it.
The way you were describing failure of marriage was divorce. As a mother of children, to me, a child being in a miserable marriage would be just as much, if not failure...
I don't know why I didn't mean to, if that was the message, and that's not the message.
Okay. And my other question was, is that you're speaking about couples going for counseling while they're dating and
I'm not recommending, I'm just saying what I've seen.
Right. Yeah. How much do you feel of failure is personal midos, meaning a person who is selfish, a person who is less accepting, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
How much do you feel that it's two specific people together with, you know, how much of it is a personal thing, their personal own needos, and that you can work on with
right.
a child
right.
when they're 10 and 12, et cetera?
Right. Right.
And how much is it specific?
Good. Very good question. Together? Very good question. A little too difficult for me to answer, but very good question. What's the question? The question, as I understand it, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, is, and I see this a lot, because I'll just explain it and maybe you'll hear the question. A bacher works on himself in yeshiva. He goes to Musar Seder, he listens to his Rebbe, he goes home for Shabbos. He's a good boy. He's not a perfect boy, Baruch Hashem, but he's a good boy. He's married 3 months in, and all of a sudden this good boy, these midos are just sort of, they're bubbling over, and he's not such a good boy all the time. So how much is it personal midos, and how much is it the marriage that's fueling the bad midos? Is that sort of what you're asking?
Maybe I'll speak to the question better. I'm thinking how much of, when you see a failed marriage,
yes.
a problematic marriage,
yes.
how much of it could be prevented by personal midos, and how much of it has to do with person A and B, meaning the combination, the interaction between the two people.
Okay. I think the second one I mentioned over here was red line bad midos as a major contributor over here. So I can't say it can solve everything, but it usually can solve everything.
I think she's asking something else.
Please.
I think
Please.
I think she's asking, when there's problems in marriage,
yes,
how much is because just the two sides are not working together?
Yeah.
The problem is just the two sides is not working.
It's almost never that.
And how much of it is just that every person has to just work on himself?
It's almost never that.
It's almost never that.
It's almost never that.
So that's the answer.
It's almost never that. It's almost never that. I'd like to say the other way, but that's not what I've seen. Yes.
You're saying it's mainly
midos.
One person's bad midos?
No. I'm saying one person can change the whole, can change it around. If he saw the marriage as the mokum for where he works on himself instead of being over-dependent on relationship. I'm saying something that sounds paradoxical, so maybe I need to explain it a little bit. One of the major forces of driving early divorce is this overemphasis on relationship between the two. They come to therapy, they talk it out, he talks it out, she talks it out, and they keep on talking, and he comes home early from Kollel, and they keep on talking, and the more they talk, the less they don't get anywhere. They just get into more and more conflict and more unresolved states, because one thing leads to another, it leads to another. If you took one out of the system and said, look, you want to have a good marriage? Work on yourself. Be married? Work on yourself. The marriage is a place for you to work on yourself. No, but I love her, I want to get married to her. Yeah, I'm not saying don't love her. I'm saying this is the place. If you saw marriage as a spiritual, as a dover ruchni, in the sense of this is where you perfect yourself, so everything has to be about you taking responsibility and accountability. That's what, is that clear? Yeah? Gottman actually does a lot of research. That's his claim to fame. He actually says this, you know. It's nice. It's nice when you see things in your office that the data correlates. He says when women take responsibility for their part, that is a great contributor to the health and well-being of the couple. He says for a man, when a man accepts influence from his wife, he said that's his contribution to the marital well-being. So for him, because it's an ego thing. So what? I mean, it's a little bit different. See, this data I quote and I throw it around, but there's a perfidy. There's a sort of inherent lie in throwing around this data, that it's built on secular couples, and then a firm guy gets up and he starts talking about this thing and this data and this divorce rate and the second divorce and this that. And it does and doesn't correlate, you know. So it has to be really explained how it does and doesn't correlate. So I don't like to be so meh on this type of thing. But in this case, I think it bears out. I think, yes, sir.
In reading the Garden of the Moon, the rather based on the Brussels, there's a lot of talk about each man has his responsibilities in the Garden of the Moon, how to understand his wife, what she needs, and address himself very much in terms of the Jewish approach to marriage.
Yeah.
So he has a similar book for women, which obviously I read.
Okay.
Telling her what she should understand the man, what he needs.
Right.
And that's, to me, that's the kind of counseling, or premarital counseling, that's missing. That kind of understanding, not only working on oneself, which is very much what most marriages do for somebody, if they know how to use it, but also working on how you approach relationship with your mate.
Okay.
A lot of that is missing. A lot of it's contributing. A lot of it's confusion, because there's that whole ethos of how you're supposed to think about marriage, and then there's the outside secular influences of how you're supposed to think about marriage, and
right.
and the ease with which you get into divorce, which really shouldn't happen.
Okay.
So how do we reconcile that? That's a big problem.
I think you're on top of it.
I'm not.
I think you clearly articulated a major challenge to the firm world today.
Okay. Even an answer.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Before getting married, everybody wants a happy marriage.
That's what I said in here.
What is more important when looking for a happy marriage? Finding the right spouse or working on oneself?
Finding, you're not going to find the right spouse, you're going to find the good enough spouse. That's one.
Is that crucial, or is it more important to work on oneself? Meaning, can you have a happy marriage even if you found the wrong spouse?
All I can tell you is David Orlovsky, I heard him speak. I heard David Orlovsky speak, and he was talking about what a great relationship he has with his wife. How they for bring together, and they talk, and they schmooze, and they, you know, and they have a great relationship. And somebody asked him, is she your zivug? And they've been married, I don't know, 30 years, 40 years. And he said, I don't know. David Orlovsky, what else is he going to say? Well, I don't know. Okay. I don't know. So he said, who knows? Velvez. Meaning that he's not holding by these questions driving him. He just found the good enough. He found the compatible. He found something that was matin, and he went with it. When he was talking a bit about, I think, when we start looking further than that, it gets very confusing, and we start asking ourselves unanswerable questions. Questions that don't really have a good enough answer. As we say in Beis Medrash, the kasha is better than the teretz. So, when it comes to our life, what do? Well, we can stop and we can keep on looking, we keep on running around and round and round, with an inherently unanswerable question. At some point, it really is Kikriyas Yamsuf, it's Nachshon Ben Aminadav, you come to a point where you have to go with it. Every man comes to that point where he has Ki Yikachish, you know, there has to be a Kicha, it has to be a taking, and he has to have the courage to do that. Your Kash is better than my Teretz, but I think that's... Yes.
How does age play in when, you know, everyone says, oh, she's too young. Oh, she's too... How do you know when that's the time to start to do it on a specific time?
Oh.
Because everyone says, oh, too young. Wait,
hold on.
Year.
Yeah,
does that really make a difference?
Is the air conditioner?
No, it's it. I don't know. It seems everybody... too young. To me, it's not about chronological age. It's about maturity. I had a couple. She was 22. He was 25, 26 maybe at the time. She was extremely mature, worked out person. He was not. How do you know? In terms of age, the question is about age. I don't really look at age.
So how do you know when a person is mature enough to get married?
Ask Bubby. Ask Bubby. Bubby's not around. Who do you ask? That's the question. I can tell you the opposite. I can tell you how you know when they're not ready. They're not ready when they ask, when the mothers, I had a mother call up and says, Mordechai, do you work with, you know, my son, he's one of the best boys in your Yerushalayim. Do you work with somebody like that? I said, Mom, I only work with the best boys in Yerushalayim. Bring him in. Sat with him, did therapy, back and forth. He says he wants to go back. He wants to go back. All his guys are going back. All his bros. It's time. He's the right age.
Back where?
He said, what?
Back where?
To the States. He was here for a bit of time. So he's ready to go back. So the big day came when he was going to say, you know, Mordechai, we had a Skype call, the parents were on the computer, and I was in the office, and he was there, and they say, because what do you think, Mordechai, is he ready to, you know, go on Shaduchim? And I said, absolutely not. No. Absolutely not. And he looked at me, and I looked at him, and I said, don't worry, it's going to be okay, but marriage is not what's happening for you right now. And I don't say that jokingly, and I don't say that smugly, and I don't say that because it's so serious. I have to say it in a funny way. But I personally or professionally do not, you know, want to be a part of these type of situations where I really feel, you know, definitive. You know, I feel as much as I can feel that it's not going to go well.
What?
Now I don't have to. Well, hold on 1 second. Now I don't have to play God. You know, life is going to teach him that it's not going to go well, because if he's going to be mishadach with somebody that is going to expect more, then it's not going to go well anyway. So I feel like I'm just saying the inevitable, or pointing out the elephant in the room because nobody else can. But how do you know when somebody's ready? You know when the extremes are not ready. You know when the extreme is not ready, if you have a very strong sense that he's not ready, you know that. And when the other extreme is when he's ready, when he's a good boy and he's solid and he's ready to take something on, take that. It's the gray area where everybody winds up. Either you wind up in a Rebbe's office, a therapist's office, or a Kabbalist's office. So I guess those are our three choices here. If there's anybody else, good. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Yeah. Gentlemen, if you could take chairs downstairs, it would be very helpful. Back to the basement.
Excuse me. Before the 4 points, that this person said that he definitely could have bought a book, but they couldn't take.
Yeah. And criticism and anger. Yeah.
Can I blow out the jewel cover? I bought a new one. It's yours, so I didn't want it.
It's ripped.
Yeah? It's ripped. I bought a new one.
Yeah.